Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am a Jito Ryo master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
This is both a Comic Book Crazy and a Tom's Prerogative / Absolution Network special. As the Absolution Network and Comic Book Crazy proudly brings to you the Wizard World Philadelphia 2012 Con Report, brought to you by Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, a podcast that reviews every Godzilla movie ever made. Join the fun at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. So, yes, folks, I am your primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis. I am back from Philadelphia. Well, I got back Sunday. Then there was Monday, which was E3. Still E3. I'm getting this out of the way for the Nintendo press conference, and I expect a E3 sort of report later in the week, but yeah, I'm here live, you know, it's just a busy couple of weeks, because Wizard World Philly during the last weekend, E3 during this week, and then Anime Next weekend. I'm finally going to be able to really rest, I think, sometime third week of June, and then only for maybe a day or two. But yeah, I'm back from Philadelphia, and it was really an experience. And so, live to you is a con report. I'm gonna go over, you know, my experience, sort of the step by step, day by day experience I went through at Wizard World. I'm then gonna give my pros and my cons. Then you're gonna hear some interviews I conducted with some artists. I say artists because I did wish to try to get more variety of guests at Wizard World. They didn't have a lot of writers. Really none that I could interview. And pretty much all the media guests, or at least the ones I wanted to interview, weren't available. Which, you know, that happens. You know, you have to go through their handlers and everything. So for the most part, I was left with artist guests. Which is great, because really I got to talk with artists about, you know, what's going on with comics today. And got some really good interviews, and that's going to be at the end. So, first, you know, let's get right into it. Let's get started with our con report of Wizard World Philadelphia 2012.
Home. slips, digging my kicks, digging on the comics. I like to save them, and I like to trade them. I read them, I need them, I'm living every page. Every time I pass a comic book counter,
let's start it where we start. You know, the funny thing is there was a lot of firsts. This is probably the biggest convention I've gone to date. You know, I've really only been to three conventions. I've been to, ShadowCon, but I've been to SpookyCon in Orlando, which is kind of pretty big, I guess. It seemed small to me. A little bit bigger than the ShadowCon, but definitely still smaller than MetroCon. But I've been to SpookyCon in Orlando once. I've been to ShadowCon the very first year it opened. You know, me and Chris and Jane were there. I've been to ShadowCon once. And of course, I've been to MetroCon since 2006. So 6 years I've been going to MetroCon. In fact, this will be the first year I haven't gone to MetroCon since I started going in 2006, and that's a con that just gets larger and larger. It's really funny to realize I'm not going to be going to MetroCon this year. MetroCon is not this weekend, but the following weekend, in fact. And I actually did look into trying to see if I could go because, it's MetroCon. To an extent, it was like a tradition for me. It was forming. But I couldn't really find the way, and I didn't want to force people to have to, like, come and pick me up at, like, 11 o'clock at night in Tampa. Not that it's in a bad place, but, you know, especially when you're just visiting, asking them, oh, hey, yeah, can you pick me up 3 days? But, yeah, there was definitely that. Wizard World Philly was definitely the biggest con I've been to of date. It was also really the first con where, to an extent, I completely went there and came home by myself. You know, I actually can't drive. I ride the bus and, you know, stuff like that. I ride public transportation. And, like, with MetroCon, I had been able to ride the bus there on Friday morning, but for the most part, I needed people to come pick me up. So, really, I had an experience where I was able to go to a convention really just by myself, really without any help. In this case, there was actually a subway train that was in New Jersey that went into Philadelphia, into the Market Station and everything, and actually, the terminal was connected to the convention center. So, outside of being dropped off at the train station, you know, other people do need to get dropped off at the train station. Pretty much, I handled going and coming back from Wizard World Philly all by myself, which was an only experience, you know. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but, you know, for me, who, you know, I'm very limited in my transportation options, it was actually very enjoyable to have some self-reliance of being able to go to a convention. I mean, there's many cons I've been wanting to go to in the past, but again, because of distance and, you know, travel and everything, it's just I can't go. One of them being MegaCon, by the way. It also happened to be really my first time on a train, which it's kind of misleading to say, but my train experience is, you know, one time I was on a New York City subway, way back when I was a kid with my sister. We were visiting Aunt Bunny, and she took us on the subway for a station. We rode it from one station to the very next station, got off, walked back. That was our ride on the subway. And, you know, it was in Brooklyn, above ground. It wasn't underground. Besides that, you know, my train experience is the sort of monorail at Tampa International Airport, the monorail at Walt Disney World, and the steam engine train at Walt Disney World. That's my experience with trains. So to an extent, really my first kind of time really riding a real true type of train, and being in a subway for that matter, you know, going underground, going into tunnels and stuff like that. Which, you know, may sound typical and like, why is this interesting? But to me, it was interesting. It was something neat. It was something new. So I did enjoy that aspect of getting to do some new things. It was a very unique way to travel to the convention. Because, you know, you go into the subway. You go into the Market Street station, which is connected to pretty much, I think, all the subways in Philadelphia. And Market Street, it's really this gallery to where you can go to street level from the station, but you can also go through these doors, and you're basically, in this mall called the Gallery, where it's three levels. The bottom level is actually underground. The second level is street level. And the third level, there's a third level that in certain places. But it's basically this mall that you walk through. That is also serves as a connection to different stations of different subway lines in Philadelphia, which is really neat to me. I was really interested in sort of the schematics and everything of that. And it is actually connected to the convention center, though we weren't allowed to use the sort of connection to the convention center. We'll get to that in a little bit, because I have some words about that. But, yeah, basically, went to the convention center, and day one, had to wait till 11:30 because they weren't ready with press pass. But, you know, I went up and got my press pass without really any problems. You know, it's kind of funny, you know, I was checking in with the press coordinator a couple days before, you know, checking in on who I can interview and everything. So, you know, he did recognize me from the interview, so there wasn't really any problem there, which I'm very thankful for. And really, the entire Wizard World staff, wonderful people, very courteous, very kind, very cheerful, considering that they probably had to deal with over 20,000 people over the weekend. So on day one, for the most part, day one, you know, the convention opened around 12. The first, like, 2 or 3 hours, I pretty much spent doing a couple of interviews, doing some shopping, and taking pictures of the main convention floor, which, you know, again, I really like to set up the main convention floor. We'll get into sort of the setup later. In fact, let's get into it now. I don't know why I'm going to get to it. Let's get into how they had the convention itself set up. For the most part, it was mostly on the second floor of the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Philadelphia. The main floor and sort of, registration was in Hall A, B, and C, which were these giant halls. Halls B and C were basically combined to be the actual main floor of the convention center. They had the vendors. They had the, you know, the guests, you know, where you can get in line to get autographs and photos, and Artist Alley. In fact, it was, to an extent, it was kind of like three pillars. When you walked into that floor from Hall A, because Hall A was nothing but registration. It was just wide open, and just nothing set up for people to get in line. Paul, like I said, Hall B and C were the main floor. And you walk in, and the very first couple of rows are vendors. The second pillar for a couple of rows is basically guest booths, where guests were signing autographs and taking photos. Then there was a couple, like two or three more rows of vendors, and then you had Artist Alley at the far end, where artists were selling, you know, their art. And it was a pretty good setup, very basic and very enjoyable, and everything sort of pretty much in the same room. Here's where it gets a little bit difficult. They had I can't remember if they had three or four, but I know they had like three panel rooms, And then they had a theater that was really pretty much only used on Saturday for, like, the real, like, the three big guest panels that they did, which was Stanley, Chris Hemsworth, and the five Star Trek captains. The theater, remember I told you how the convention center was connected to the Market Street Station? Well, right where you come in from the Market Street Station, it's actually this open area, and that's where the theater is, the ballroom. It's the way the convention center is shaped, it's kind of like an, I want to say an L, but not quite, but that's kind of what it reminded me most of. But yeah, pretty much kind of like an L, with the short sort of L part, like, you know, if you look at the letter L, the bottom part that shoots out, it's the part that's sort of connected to the convention center, to the Market Street Station. It was sort of its walkway, but it has its own panel rooms, and in fact, it has the ballroom, which is where the panels were. But that's where that's where the theater panel was. The actual panel rooms A, B, and C, were at the complete and other end of the L. So, if you look at an L, the panel room A, B, and C were at the very top, and then the ballroom / theater where three main panels on Saturday were held were at the bottom left. I mean, as far away from each other as possible. Again, we'll talk about more of this when we get into sort of positives and negatives. So that's pretty much what the setup was. So you had the main exhibitor floor in the middle between the distance of the panel rooms and the theater. And, I mean, I didn't go to all events. There were some events that happened late at night because I wanted to come home at a certain time. So I could get a ride home, that is. I didn't get to go to certain things like, there were some outside the con convention things, you know, sort of geek parties and stuff like that I didn't get to attend. That heard really, really good. I didn't get to go to any movie showings or anything like that. And there were some, like, horror movies being shown. But, like I said, first two or three hours, again, just pretty much did some interviews. In fact, most of my interviews. Did a little bit of shopping and took a lot of cosplay pictures. That was for the first couple hours. And then I went down for one panel. I went to a Star Wars panel. That starred Peter Gerard, Jamie Barak, who was Boba Fett. He also played some doctors in Doctor Who. And Peter Mew, who, you know, again, Chewbacca. So I went to their panel where they talked Star Wars. I did ask them a question. But, you know, and that was a fun panel. And then pretty much for the rest of Friday, I went back up to the convention, took some more pictures, and pretty much hanged out there. There was really not any other panels that were to my liking of going to that I felt could add to the experience, at least on my mind. Okay, we'll also get to sort of panel selection in a little bit. Saturday was the big day. Saturday, that thing was packed. Packed tighter than jam. It was very hard to get around on the main convention floor. I mean, just, oh my God. If you were at the very far end of the exhibitor floor, because there's like a refreshment stand at the very far end, if you're there to get there to the exit, and which, by the way, there were like doors, exit ball, hall C and B, but the convention center staff. And allow me to make this differentiation. There were two sets of staff. There was the Wizard World Convention staff, which were nice and courteous, and then there was the Convention Center staff, which I will get to them in a little bit, which I'll probably tell you it's not a good thing I have to say about them. But they wouldn't let you through the doors, or at least to exit, which made no sense. But yeah, you had to walk through the hall and go through Hall A and to go out. So, to get through there, you had to go through the monstrosity that was the Saturday crowd. And, oh my God, was it packed. Again, that's great news for Wizard World Philadelphia, and wow, I'm so glad they were able to sell that many. It was just a hassle to get through. And then, of course, you add the BO from certain people of, like, I put tons of cologne on that morning, but I know that by the end of the night, I was going to smell awful. Not because I had been sweating, but just because the collective BO from some people were going to rub off on me. Again, allow me to quote my friend Chris in saying, soap, use it. I do. And cologne, too. And I don't say that to be mean to anybody, but again, it's a broom, people, BO is going to happen, and people still don't know to use soap. But Saturday, I got there around 10, went around the convention center, basically just taking pictures. Well, in fact, I didn't start taking pictures. Allow me to retract that statement. When I got there, first thing I did was try to locate the theater, which in itself, I didn't locate the theater until Saturday. And in itself, like I said, was a hassle because it was very confusing the way they had the sign set up. But finally located it, sat down, waited for them to open for media because there was a couple media guests that were there waiting to get into the stand, because it was the Stan Lee panel I was going to. And, really great time actually talking with the media guys. There was a sort of small podcast from Pennsylvania. I don't have their card on me, but yet, multi-podcast, that just started out, so I was giving them some tips and another podcast. And, you know, it's sort of the great thing about media is that we're like, all one big family. We're talking about logistics of how we're shooting and stuff like that, which I found would be really, really fun and really relaxing, to be completely honest. But they let us in, and, you know, we set up our shots. I was in the very... It was like this big theater, and I was like, I don't know exactly how to describe it. It's like, sort of like, I don't want to say stadium seating. It wasn't like stadium seating because they were chairs. But it's like, but the chairs were set up in like sections of like, I want to say 20 chairs each with like 10, 15 rows, possibly. And so you had, trying to count, sorry as I do math in my head, but you had 12 of these sections, possibly 16, going all the way back in this giant ballroom. I was in the sort of second section in the middle. Like, there was this big middle courtway. I was in the second section of to the right of the middle courtway. Again, you'll see in the video, because again, I did shoot video, and this is one of the panels where I shot video for. Stanley panel was something. In fact, the first half hour, they actually had a sort of host slash DJ for like that, and the Chris Hemsworth, and I guess the Star Trek captains. I'll get to why I didn't go to that in a second. Panels, but Jared Krypton, who was the second season winner of Who Wants to Be a Superhero, which is, again, hosted by Stan Lee. Yeah, so for the first half hour, he was there telling jokes and, you know, sort of emceeing as they tried to get Stan Lee to the theater. So he showed up pretty much about a half hour late. Understandable. So it was pretty much only a half hour panel as far as when Stan Lee was there. But I did get to ask a question, and I caught most of the... In fact, I caught pretty much all of the panel on tape. I shouldn't say on tape, on the camcorder, on, you know, digital. So, but after the Stan Lee panel, I went back to the main exhibitor hall. I walked around. I actually bought a little bit more art. I took more pictures. Did one or two more interviews with some more guests who had come on Saturday. Knowing I had three more interviews to try to conduct on Sunday because I had been asked to wait till Sunday. But from there, went to the Chris Hemsworth panel, which meant going back to the theater. Didn't record that, but I took a lot of pictures from that panel, and it's like a Scott McNeil panel amped up to 20, really. I mean, I'm not surprised by the panel because, again, like I said, I've been to a Scott McNeil panel where there is glumping galore, but, like, girls just coming up asking for hugs. Like, sure. And Chris Hemsworth giving a hug. And, like, really nice guy. And the same thing, by the way, with Stan Lee was with Chris Hemsworth. You know, this
feeling like I'm basically 20 feet away from this mega ultra movie star who I've seen a month ago on the big screen playing Thor, the God of Thunder. There's a feeling there that you just can't describe how amazing that is. And the same thing was for Stan Lee. You know, Stan Lee, the man who created Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, Captain America, the Hulk, all of these characters. This is the man who created it. And it's sort of be in his presence was absolutely incredible. And I definitely hope I get to experience it again. But I went to the Chris Hemsworth panel. That was a fun panel. Nothing really special or anything, but, you know, it was fun. You know, a lot of positive energy and everything came from that panel. Again, went back to the exhibitor hall, looked for cosplay to take pictures of. Hanged out pretty much until, for about another hour, till 3. I decided I want to go to the Bruce Campbell panel. Which, again, this is all the way down in A, B, and C. In fact, this is in room B. So went to the Bruce Campbell panel, and I have to say this, panel of the convention was the Bruce Campbell. Bruce Campbell was the funniest person at the convention. Funny as hell. God, I really enjoyed that panel. The only thing negative I can really say about the panel is I didn't get to get my question asked. Which, you know, again, that's just, I didn't get called, which is unfortunate, but, you know, if that's the only thing you can say bad about the panel, then it's really nothing at all. It's nitpicking. And I can't hold it. It was a perfect 10 for a panel. Bruce Campbell was funny as hell. Means Bruce Campbell, the awesome one himself. Sam Axe, Ash from the Evil Dead series. And, of course, my personal favorite, Magnanimous, which, by the way, that was the question I wanted to ask him about, was about that character. But Magnanimous from Magus XLR. But he showed up to the panel in sort of a white sort of suit and everything, just looking fly, and just throwing one-liners and everything, and just a joy to listen to. At that point, my legs were really hurting, because I'm doing all of this walking constantly on my feet, pretty much for hours on end. Your legs start to hurt, because apparently in the Pennsylvania Convention Center, they had not heard of things called chairs. There were chairs, but it's like near the panel rooms, there were these sort of comfy chairs, and like outside the theater. But that's it. There were no like chairs in the main exhibitor floor or outside the hallway by the main exhibitor floor. You really had to travel to find a chair, and there was very few of them, and usually they were always taken. And no sockets, by the way, which is really strange. So, I spent a lot of time on my feet standing up. I mean, when I was really tired, I took a few minutes to sit down, but really, with all my gear on, just constantly standing up, that point of Saturday, my legs were really tired, and I was like, the Bruce Campbell panel came out, and I was planning on going to the Star Trek panel where the five captains met. The five captains were William Shatner, Patrick Stewart, Johnson, I want to say, Kate McGrew, and Scott Bakula, who, again, was on Star Trek Enterprise. And I did, because, by the way, it was Avery Brooks, not Avery Johnson, Avery Brooks, so I apologize. But that was the Star Trek panel. I wanted to go to it, but my legs were killing me, and so I decided to go to the next panel room over, which was panel room A, and go to the Evil Dead panel, which featured Betsy Baker, the gentleman who played Scott. Pretty much the three ladies from the first Evil Dead movie and Scott. And that was a blast. It was a very small panel, and you know, mostly just us and the actors chatting a bit. And then I pretty much stayed there, because the very next panel after that, which was about, that panel ended at 4:45, and the next panel was going to start at 5:30, that panel being the CM Punk panel. Now, CM Punk was a guest, and by the way, when I was in the exhibitor hall of Saturday, I saw the line for CM Punk when he finally got there. Oh my God. What they had for the line wasn't big enough, and it went like all the way to the down the red carpet that they had and everything. Longest line. And by the way, I kind of find it funny that with all these major actors and everything, even Chris Hemsworth and Stan Lee, none of them had a police escort. CM Punk was the only one who had to have a police escort with him, because that's how popular he was. and we'll get to some, like, planning of that in a second. But stay for the CM Punk. They actually had the CM Punk panel in this room that could only fit, like, 304 people. And they found out, as the panel was approaching, that there probably could be, like, 400 people showing up for the panel. At least. So, like, they had to stuff it with chairs. Mind you, as all this was happening, when I was in the Evil Dead panel, I actually had a wardrobe malfunction. My belt broke. So, my pants were falling down. So, I had pants that are falling down. I'm in a panel. I'm stuck in the middle for the CM Punk panel, which is why when you see the video of the CM Punk panel, the camera shakes and moves a lot. So, I apologize for that. But the CM Punk panel, outside of that, was absolutely incredible. Tremendously fun. Really, really enjoyed it. And pretty much after that panel, I had to go home, so I went home for that day. And Sunday was a really light day. I got one more interview. The last two had to cancel. One canceled because, you know, he was feeling a bit hoarse in his throat, and he didn't want to ruin his voice. And the other, you know, I actually waited most of the day to try to find out. When I found out he actually had to go home for an emergency and wasn't coming back for Sunday, that's actually around the time I left on Sunday, because he was pretty much the last person I needed to interview. But that guest, again, this is an artist guest I'm waiting for. But between waiting for him, you know, again, I pretty much just went around the exhibitor hall, took pictures, and actually conducted a couple of Artist Alley segments for the video. Again, look for the video around the end of July, I want to say. There you're going to have the Stan Lee panel, the CM Punk panel, and some Artist Alley segments. So that should be a fun video when it gets released in late July. In fact, I'm probably going to combine those videos with the videos I'm going to get at Anime Next, which is this coming weekend. So, like, it's gonna be a jam-packed video. So, pretty much that was Sunday. Took pictures, as of, really didn't go to any panels. Most of it was on Saturday. At the end of the day, if I had to rate the Wizard World Philadelphia Convention, I would have to rate it a 8.5 out of 10. It was a really, really good convention. A lot of people seemed happy. Again, we're about to get into positives and negatives into a second here, but, you know, for the most part, most of the, like, sort of negatives, or should I say cons of the con, to do a pun there, most of them are actually nitpicking, and then the other two really have nothing to do with the Wizard World Convention itself. It's something outside of that that kind of hampered the experience, but we'll get to that. But, like I said, really just enjoyed it. It was great. The Wizard World staff was tremendous. I really had to be nitpicky to find things wrong that Wizard World did. So, absolutely incredible. I really enjoyed it. I look forward to hopefully going back next year. With that, we're going to take a quick break. You're going to hear a promo or two. And when we do, we're going to come back and I'm going to ultimately give the pros and cons of the Wizard World Philadelphia Con.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story I want you on straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bust!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us. And so, from Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations to the audio drama and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going up!
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu.
I lied when I said you could go. At least partially lied, for I will let you go to another dimension.
The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
Let's start with pros. I love the setup of the main conference room. Again, like I said before, it was sort of like it was three pillars, you know, when you first came in. And for that matter, include registration. You know, the first hall you come in, it's this big, gigantic hall, really just for registration, which is basically Hall A, which, again, I like. And then Hall B and C was the actual floor, which, again, had vendors, had the guests and their photo op booths and autograph booth, for that matter, and then, of course, Artist Alley. And again, like I said, I like that setup. It was sort of like pillars. You had a pillar of, you know, vendors. Then you had a pillar of guests, you know, photo op stations, you know, where, you know, they signed autographs and took pictures with people all the way up and down. Then you had, a very small pillar of, like, vendors, going the length of the hall. And then you had... Not the rest was Artist Alley, and it was very easy to Artist Alley. You had to go to the other end of the room, vendors, front of the room, you know, guests, you know, there, and it was very easy to maneuver through. So I very much enjoyed that. Another pro that I like, I love sort of the family atmosphere that was of the con, and I love the fact that you saw a lot of sort of family cosplays at the convention center. A couple photos you'll see in the coming weeks. One, I had a photo of a family. I get the dad was an Eradicator. The mom was, I want to say, sort of the original Wonder Woman costume, you know, with the skirt and everything. So I would say like early 60s, 50s Wonder Woman. And then they had their child, their daughter, who was dressed up as Chitara. I have the photo. And then there was another family that was basically, I think the daughter was Mary Marvel or something around that line. The mother, again, was a Wonder Woman, more of a modern Wonder Woman. And the dad was a, I want to say, a Bronze Age Superman. Sort of Earth 2, sort of old school Superman costume. I hope I'm getting it right, but that I'll have that photo up as well, because I did take a photo of him, because I thought he looked cool. And that's just some of the families I saw. And I saw a lot of other families, and you know, so where not just the children were dressed up, but the parents were dressed up as well, and it was a family event. And I really loved the family atmosphere. At the same time, it wasn't too... And I don't know maybe if this is because it's a northern convention and this is being up north. And I've noticed this as I've moved to New Jersey and sort of the more northern states, as opposed to Florida, where to where they are very strict about, we have to keep a PG-13, please don't say anything. Not that stuff doesn't get said, but they immediately have to apologize, and there are people that will offend about that. Here, if somebody slips and says the F-bomb... You know, they just joke about it, and nobody complains, which is kind of, you know, which, you know, did happen from a couple of guests, you know, which happens. But, you know, again, it was just this family atmosphere, and it was just this fun atmosphere as well, which is another pro, the atmosphere. Like I said, the family atmosphere, but also just the fun atmosphere. Everybody was, even though, especially on Saturday when we were just sort of packed in that hall, and there was BO and everything, most people still had a good... And they were serving beer, too. I was very afraid that there might be a couple of drunk people or everything, because beer... From my experience, beer at a convention is never a good thing. I point to MetroCon 2008-2009, when we had to share the convention space with the Red Bull Flutog event, which was at Tampa that year. Yeah. There's a reason I don't drink anything that's called Red Bull. Or support the company Red Bull. It's because of that. Maybe I'm holding a grudge, maybe I'm not. But that's besides the point. But yeah, here, you know, just a very family-friendly, very fun atmosphere that was very, very enjoyable. I love the Artist Alley. There was so much wonderful art. Not just the art I bought. And let's be honest, I did buy a lot of fan service art. Because, hey, I'm Thomas M. Mattis. Allow me to introduce myself to you. I'm the guy that buys a lot of etchy art. If you don't already know. But... back on point, Artist Alley was just beautiful. So much wonderful art. I wish I had a lot more money so I could pretty much buy from everyone, because there were a lot of people that had very good art. And again, pretty much everybody that was running either a vendor or an Artist Alley table was so very friendly. You know, again, adding to that friendly atmosphere. I don't have much experience with pretty much the guest autograph and photo op area, because I didn't go get any autographs or photo ops. I got a couple of autographs, but from Artist Alley, which is free, and there's really no lines, and I'm not counting that for that reason. But pretty much everybody was friendly. The panels I went to all were fun. That's another positive. The Chris Hemsworth panel was basically just like a Gundam Wing panel to me. That's my point of reference for any panel to where a guy is that's just being bring popular to the girls is it's like a Gundam Wing panel, or for that matter, a Scott McNeil panel. But all the panels were good. Stan Lee panel was fun for what it was. I mean, I wish that he was able to get there quicker to form more questions, but, you know, it's understandable considering his age that he wasn't able to get there faster. So, really, I really don't want to complain about that. And I'm not, for that matter. I mean, I got to ask him a question, which was cool. But the Chris Hemsworth panel was awesome. I heard the Star Trek panel was awesome, even though I didn't get to go. Like I said before, the Bruce Campbell panel was freaking awesome. Like, I'm going to make the statement right now. Best panel of the con was the Bruce Campbell panel. That's my opinion. And I love CM Punk. I love Stan Lee and Chris Hemsworth. But that was the panel of the convention. The Star Wars and the Evil Dead panel I went to was fun. And CM Punk, you know, even though there was a mistake made in sort of panel, which we'll get to because it is part of my con, points. The CM Punk panel was just funny, you know. You gotta understand, as somebody who, I think I said this before, but, you know, as somebody who is a wrestling fan, I really don't have many wrestling friends online to talk to. And for, you know, that ain't, or should I say, on a regular basis on Skype, or for that matter, around me. And so to be in a room with other wrestling fans, professional wrestling fans, and to be able to do all the cheers you see on TV, no, yes, 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 yeah, yo, CM Punk, CM Punk, CM Punk, yo. To be able to do all this stuff with other people and not feel weird, it was just a joyous experience. CM Punk was just an awesome guest. I love the concession stands, that they weren't too expensive. Then again, pretty much all I bought from there was some sodas during the con to give me some caffeine. But it was pretty much, they weren't too expensive from what I saw, which I see as a pro. Yeah, and finally, I'll leave with this. I actually wanted to say this first, but I kind of forgot to say this as the first pro. And I really feel bad, but last pro I'll talk about is the Wizard World Con staff. Again, I'm making the sort of distinction here between the Wizard World Con staff and the Convention Center Con staff. You'll see in a couple of minutes. The Wizard World Con staff was absolutely excellent. They were friendly. They were inviting, you know. They welcome all questions you had for them, and they just never made you feel like you weren't welcome, which was wonderful. I point this out because, you know, when the CM Punk panel was happening, one of the people that was helping covering it, she obviously had been working all day. You know, she was obviously dead tired. You could see it in her, but still, she was able to have a smile and be cheerful, and, you know, I had a question she answered nicely. She didn't make me feel like, oh, why are you asking me this question? You know, she was welcoming in my question. She answered it quickly and efficiency, and she made me feel welcome to be at that convention. And that was pretty much the entire con staff. Even when the ones that were working autograph booths and everything like that, just, they were welcoming, they were inviting, they were helpful. And they really made the con a fun experience. And I thank the Wizard World Con staff, both the con staff that was volunteering and helping, and the people working administration and registration. They were all fun. You know, you could just sit there and talk with them about the con, as I did on several occasions throughout the convention. And, you know, just, they were welcoming, and I very much appreciate that. Because a con staff, you know, considering how a con staff, you know, acts around the guests and with the guests, they can make a average con seem great and a good con seem bad. So I'm very, very happy that, you know, they were very welcoming, and thank you. And I thank the con staff for that. Let's move on to cons of the Wizard World Philadelphia convention. I mean, I really have not that many. Really, only five I can really think of off the top of my head. The first two, in fact, the first three, to an extent, are kind of nitpicky. But the third one is, to an extent, I feel legitimate. But I'll get to that in a second. The first two is, I didn't like the distance between the panel rooms and the theater. I mean, looking at it objectively, it was a, I saw what the layout was. You had the panel rooms, and it was sort of a, you know, station by station type of thing. If you're at the panel rooms, you stop at the station of the, you know, exhibitor hall. Then the next station is, of course, the theater, and of course you go back. But I just didn't like how they were spaced out. I would have liked them more closer together. In fact, for that matter, you know, I just, maybe it's because they were big ballrooms themselves. I don't know, which is why I kind of hate saying this. But there were, like, apparently, like, panel rooms by the theater. I would have liked to have seen them use those panel rooms as the panel rooms themselves instead of having, you know, again, you had to go downstairs to the first floor and then all the way to the far end of the convention center to go to the panel rooms. Again, I would have liked it all to be on the same floor. I would have liked it better, you know, for them to also be closer together. But it's really a minute thing, and that's me nitpicking. As is my second thing, and, you know, I'm just saying this for the sake of saying this. I don't even know if I can really call this a con, because it's not like I didn't know this was there and that it was going to happen. But just some of the prices for some people's autographs or photos, you know, when... I mean, I know they're big, major motion picture superstars like Chris Hemsworth, but I don't know how people were able to afford his, like, $100, $150 autograph, but, you know, $150 for a person's autograph. It's like, it just seems insane to me. I mean, I knew it was there, knew it was coming. It didn't bother me, especially because I wasn't getting any autographs from any actors or that stuff. But still, it's just that it just seems insane to me that you have these people that are making millions and millions of dollars on their own from their movies and stuff, and they need to charge $100 for their autograph or for a photo with them. You know, it just doesn't seem right to me. Again, and look, I understand why it's done that way. I understand that there are people who their sole purpose to going to convention is they pay the $200 for the photo and the autograph, and then they go and sell it on eBay for $500. Probably, you know, $500, $600 for that matter. So I understand. You're trying to get a piece of that pie with what's happening on eBay. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the only people you're punishing are the people who can't afford to get an autograph, who can't pay $100 for a photo or an autograph. And, I mean, there were guests that had reasonable prices, and most of them were people, you know, where I understand, you know, right now that's kind of their main source of income to an extent. But at the same point in time, you know, especially with like Stan Lee and Chris Hemsworth and CM Punk, it just seemed insane. But again, like I said, that's just me nitpicking, looking for stuff to, you know, have a con or to sort of have a, you know, to put on that sort of, I guess, negative side, which I hate being negative for that matter, but on that negative side, you know, I have to be nitpicky because this convention was really, really good. Now on sort of the three legitimate things. Again, the first one really didn't bring it down that much, but it wasn't anything with the current convention staff. It's really the only sort of true problem I have with the Wizard World convention staff, and it's really with programming. They put CM Punk in panel room B. Now, again, there was the theater, which was this massive room. Then you actually had panel room A, which fit probably like 500 people. Then you had panel room B, which could fit about 300 people. Well, they put CM Punk there because they didn't expect over 300 people to come to see CM Punk or to get VIP passes. From what I heard, over 350 people bought VIP passes to see CM Punk, let alone all the people that came who didn't buy VIP passes, who are just general admission. So, yeah, it was just poor planning on their part to put CM Punk in that small room. Really, he should have been in the theater for that matter. I mean, it was just poor planning to, you know, and somebody should have just done their homework. I mean, you have the WWE champion, for that matter, the current WWE champion, who's also, along with Daniel Bryan, the face of independent wrestling right now. As far as independent wrestlers making it to the big leagues, especially. Oh, by the way, in the city that built ECW, the company that was popular in the 90s that has become the blueprint for independent wrestling circuits as we know it now. In Philadelphia, the city that made ECW. Because that's where ECW got started. It's, a lot of times it's where I believe ROH is sort of to the set located. I think I could be wrong on there. Which is like right now the third biggest wrestling promotion in the United States. So yeah, it's just poor planning. They should have done their homework and realized there were going to be a lot of people probably coming to see CM Punk. I mean, wrestling fans don't care where they have to go to see their wrestlers. Their wrestlers could be at an old woman's knitting conference. They'll buy tickets there to see their wrestler knit. That's how passionate wrestling fans are. You know, it was just something they could have planned for better. But again, the staff that was there was able to fix it quickly. They brought in chairs and everything, and they got, I think, pretty much everybody that wanted to be in the panel in the panel. And even though we were tight and sort of confirming the whole city of brotherly love aspect of Philadelphia, the panel itself was fun. So again, it didn't detract that much, and the panel was successful. Which is why I don't, you know, why, or should I say, it's why I don't think it brings down the con too much for me, but it is something to note. Now on to the two major cons of the convention. And this is what, these two things kept this convention from being perfect for me. And they just stuck out in my craw. I don't know which one's worse, but I'm going to go with sort of the one that doesn't have anything to do with sort of the convention itself. Number one, people, stop walking in front of my camera! I've been holding this anger in. You do not know how many times people would walk in front. This, again, this has nothing to do with the convention staff, the convention itself, hell, even the convention center staff, which we'll get to in a second. But this just comes with etiquette of convention goers. You do not walk in front of somebody's camera, especially when it's, you know, if somebody is holding their camera pointed at a cosplayer who's in a pose, that doesn't mean walk through the picture. Which happened several times. But that, if it just been that, it would have been okay. But the big situation where this happened was the Stan Lee panel. Now, like I said, I was pressed. You know, we were allowed to get in, you know, with the VIP so we could do setup. And like I said, I was in the middle row. Now, I have this sort of small tripod. I don't have a big tripod like the other ones have. But it was big enough. I mean, it's not like you couldn't see it. The camera and the tripod were pretty much hard to miss. You know, but I had it on the floor pointing up to look. When you see the video, you'll see how it is. But pointing up because I didn't want to put it on a chair and block somebody's view. You know, because I was trying to be considerate of the other guests as we were asked of the convention staff, which was completely understandable. People would not stop not getting in front of my camera. And look, I don't mean like, oh, they passed by the camera because they had to get to the other end of the room. Again, understandable. You know, considering I was shooting video and that stuff. But I mean, people literally stood in front of the camera to take a picture of Stan Lee on stage. Because apparently they haven't heard of Zoom. I mean, I'm not talking about people just passing by the camera. You'll see in the video, there's a guy who stands right in front of my camera! And at this point, I was at the mic because I was getting ready to ask my question, and I'm like, I can't yell because they'll hear me on the mic, and I don't want to disturb the freaking panel. But I got hovered, I'm like, I'm ready to Hulk the hell out and beat a mother. trying to beat. Oh! Oh! And it wasn't this one. Person after person after per. I don't know how I kept my. I'm very proud that I kept my cool. I will tell you this. One part that we had a laugh about this was, you know, the people beside me were looking at this along with a fellow press member who's behind me, and they were just like, dude, I am so sorry. That is horror. You know, people were just apologizing. Because how could you be so blind? I mean, it's... I don't know, I wanted to yell, and I'm sorry to anybody of the Wizard World convention staff that may be listening to this podcast. I apologize. I have to say this. Kids, put earmuffs on for about 5 seconds. I have to say this. I wanted to yell, get the f*** out of my camera! Get the f*** out of the way! How can you miss it? You can't miss it! It's a camera! My precious! Get out in front of my camera! Thank you for finally moving from in front of my camera. It doesn't take a blind person to see the camera. Have some freaking etiquette and look where you're standing. Hallelujah! Holy s***! Honey, get the Tylenol. I'm sorry. I've been wanting to rage out about that for days now. How can you not see the camera? How can you not see the camera? How can you? It was implausible to me. I'm like, they can't be this stupid. It is humanly impossible for. And they can't blame that they're rednecks because we're not in the South. And I know rednecks are everywhere, but it can't be a Southern thing. We're in the North. We're in Philadelphia, home of Benjamin Franklin, home of many geniuses that helped this country, the birthplace of the American Constitution. They cannot be this stupid. I mean, especially, like I said, that one gentleman right before I got to ask my question, which thankfully he moved. You know, before I asked my question, so we did get the video of Stan answering my question, but it's just like, dude, how do you miss it? Oh, I think I'm calm now. I apologize. I had to let that out. I could not hold it in anymore. If any consolation, I hope you guys got a good chuckle out of me raging out. But, you know, that's the first big one. Now we move on to the second big one. The Pennsylvania Convention Center staff. Now, there had been a reason throughout this entire podcast that I had been differentiating between the Wizard World Convention staff and the Pennsylvania Convention Center staff. Because they were two different people. Whereas the Wizard World Convention staff was friendly and inviting, the Pennsylvania Convention staff made me feel like, oh my god, I am ruining these people's lives. Now, let me actually, because it's actually what's kind of, I mean, the males of the Wizard, of the Pennsylvania Convention staff were friendly. You know, in fact, most of the time, they were nice, but they are either nice pointing that you have to take this exit, or they were trying to get a hot cosplayer to take a photo with them. It's like every time I turned in my head, I saw another male member of the Pennsylvania Convention staff trying to take a picture with a Wonder Woman or a Black Widow who was, again, this is the comic convention, so I don't know if it still applies, but, you know, for all us anime fans, we know that our, you know, cosplay logic is that if she looks 21, she's probably 15. That is anime convention logic for you right there. But, again, it was the female members of the convention staff that really were the problem. they just, the entire convention, every female member of the Pennsylvania convention staff, would actually, with the exception of one, and it was a store clerk, you know, when I went to get soda. She was nice. But for the most part, most, all of them had a scowl on their face, like, oh my god, I'm wasting my life away. Oh god, I hate these people. Why are they here? They're a pain in my ass. You know, that's how they made me feel. Even one that had a smile, you know, that was, it was like a teeth-gritting smile. And then just the logic that the convention, like, again, I've been telling you that I was going to get to this, but, like, the whole, how the Market Street Station / Mall Gallery is connected to the convention center and the Marriott, for that matter. Like I said, when you get to the end of the station, you go up an escalator to street level. And it's sort of this lobby, you know, again, the escalator takes you down to the station and, to that matter, the mall. You can go outside to the street, or you can go up another escalator, which has an entrance to the convention center. And in fact, at that entrance, that's where the theater was, / ballroom. And then you also had a bridge that went to the Marriott. Well, we couldn't enter the convention center from there. Why? They didn't give us a reason. We were just not allowed to enter the convention center at that point. From there, or at any point of the con, which made no sense, especially when you had a wristband to get into the convention, which, you know, that was your badge for that matter. They gave out wristbands. You know, orange was press, you know, green was general, gold was VIP. No, I had to go back down the escalator, had to walk out to the street, go down the block, make a right, go down the block to the convention center, and I couldn't go in the west end, because they had these two doors on either side of the street. I couldn't go into the west entrance and go up the escalator and just, it was same distance either way, but I couldn't do it on the west side. Oh no, I had to do it only on the east side. And I could maybe understand if this was just the first day, but no. This was every day of the convention, and it made no sense. The way we had to walk through the this is why I'm complaining about how the distance between the panels and this stuff, because the way the convention center had us move was insane. We couldn't go here, we couldn't go here, we couldn't go this way. Well, why? And for that matter, we couldn't exit down the hall to connect to the Market Street. Again, we had to go back down the escalator, back down the street, and go to the station, which some people there might be saying, but why are you complaining? I mean, it was a little walk, but it was illogical. It made no sense, and they really had no reason why people had to do it. They just wouldn't allow people to walk through that area unless they were going to the theater, which made no sense. There was no convention going on in that. There was one convention going on at the same time, but it was on the bottom floor, and again, it was right by the east, you know, entrance. It was a transgender, transvestite healthcare conference. And I really have nothing to say about it, because I really didn't interact with anybody from that conference. But there was not, where the ballroom was, there was no convention. Those were the only two conventions going on at the convention center. Nobody was interfering with each other. There was no logical reason why we could not exit going down that hall where the, you know, the theater is, and going through the exit entrance to Market Street. What would have happened if it was raining? Would we still have to go out that way? I mean, and if it's a whole point of people seeing people's wristbands, I mean, I'm sorry, you could have asked the convention staff to have a couple volunteers go to that entry point and watch people, make sure that they have bands, or if they don't, point them, get into registration. There were several checkpoints that they had that prevented people who did not have a wristband from getting in, which actually I'm praising Wizard World Philly, because it was their plan, which was brilliant. Just because somebody went in that entrance didn't mean they were going to walk around. I mean, you had people stationed so people could walk around without being seen. You know, it was illogical. It made no sense. And you add that illogical aspect of how we had to move in the convention center, with the female members of the convention staff looking at us like we are sinners to God and we are making their life horrible. And you add that with, again, the people who don't understand, do not walk in front of a camera. they were two negatives that kept this convention from being almost... I mean, if it wasn't for those things, I probably would have given this a 9.5. But those two things took an entire an entire 1.5 point away from this convention. And again, it wasn't the convention's fault, which is why I'm not taking more away. I mean, if this was something from the convention on both occasions, it would be a lot more points. But this is not something that the convention can control on either aspect. And I can't, in good faith, blame the convention, you know, Wizard World and the convention for that. But at the same point in time, it did hinder my experience of the con. If I have any suggestions, by the way, from all this to the Wizard World Convention, that is, please, please get your planners to sit down with the Pennsylvania Convention staff, have them understand that they need to be friendly to convention goers, and formulate a plan so that, you know, people can walk that area of the convention center. You know, I mean, if it's raining, you're going to make people go out in the rain outside to get into the convention center? I don't think it's that hard to sort of put volunteers at places so people could go through that entrance. You know, and that's, again, that's my suggestion for next year. Now that I've gotten all my negativity out, again, like I said, besides the things, the rest of the convention was pretty much enjoyable. I mean, I had a few nitpicks, but those two major things were the major problems I had. But other than that, the convention was fun. I definitely suggest going to Wizard World Philadelphia for anybody that's in the New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., or for that matter, you know, anywhere in the country, though I'm hesitant to say that because, like, if you're Chicago, you should definitely go to Wizard World Chicago. And really to the point, if you have a Wizard World convention near you, like Anaheim or Chicago, Phoenix or a place like that, or Dallas for that matter, definitely go to their convention. They put on a good show, and I highly, highly, you know, suggest their convention because it was absolutely wonderful. So like I said, 8 out of 10 for me for the Wizard World Philadelphia 2012 convention. With that being said, we are now going to move on to interviews to end this special episode. So you're going to hear some interviews with some artists, and when I come back, I'm going to give you the rundown of how you can email to the site and that stuff, you know, usually. But first, we're going to play a couple promos, and then we'll get into interviews. So we'll be right back.
In June of 1962, a superhero unlike any other made his first appearance in the pages of Amazing Fantasy number 15, the final issue of that series. 6 months later, this character would receive his own title, and from there he would grow in popularity and be adapted into several animated series, a handful of live-action series, both in the U.S. and abroad, have countless action figures made in his likeness, dominate the cinema screen, and much, much more. It is fair to say that the Amazing Spider-Man is a pop culture icon and a fictional character that people all over the world identify with and love. This year, Spider-Man is turning 50, and Views from the Long Box, an internet radio series hosted by me, Michael Bailey, is going to celebrate the wall crawler in a series of episodes focusing on various aspects of the character's existence. Together with such podcasting luminaries as Brad Douglas, Andrew Leyland, John Wilson, and Scott Gardner, I'm going to give Spidey the biggest birthday card a comic fan could. He may not be my favorite character, but I like him a great deal, and he deserves the spotlight in this, his 50th year. Views from the Long Box can be found at www.viewsfromthelongbox.com. New episodes hit every Friday. Views from the Long Box is a Fortress of Baileytooth production in association with the DiMonzo Corps of Milan, Italy.
Okay, let's get this show on the road, gang.
I'm Batman.
This looks like a job for Superman.
Comics Monthly Mondays, available the third Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey there, Absolution Network, Comic Book Crazy, Tokyo SOS, all the fans of 132 Productions. We're here with interviews here at Wizard World Philadelphia. Yes, I'm actually coming to you from a convention outside the state of Florida. There are so many jokes and so little time. It's Florida. There's a reason we call it God's waiting room. Okay. That voice you heard is Jamie Tidal, is that my name?
Tindall,
who is here with his gorgeous art, and surprise, surprise, as you know me, my lovable fans, he's very good at drawing the ladies. So we're here to ask Jamie a couple of questions. So first off, how did you get started in the industry?
I just started showing my portfolio around at the cons, and Zenscope took notice of me and gave me a cover the next day I showed them my portfolio.
And how many years ago was that?
I just started doing professional work in November.
So you've just been like...
6 months. I did 30 cons a year.
I hate to use the pun, but you've been rickrolled into it.
Yeah, I just got in and just started going.
Okay. So, how did you come around to your own particular art style, and how would you describe it to people?
I liked all the art from the early 90s, like when Image was founded. So my style is very, very much of the early 90s style with a little bit more advanced coloring. I was influenced by Jim Lee, Scott Campbell, Michael Turner, Silvestri, and McFarlane. So I try to stay along that style because I find that's what fans, especially the fans of the cons, really relate to the early 90s and early 2000s styles.
You can, and definitely, I say you can really see Jason Scott Campbell in your art.
A lot of people say that, that Turner and Silvestri in my work.
Turner, yeah.
But with a lot more detail than all of them.
Definitely.
Yeah, I tend to put more detail in my stuff, and that's what I got known for in the industry, is really hot girls, great covers with lots and lots of details, and very bright and vibrant colors.
I'll say this, anybody who makes me want to get a job desperately just so I can finally get a commission, like you've entered that list. It was Amanda Connor, it was Jim Balint, and I'm referring to Jason Scott Campbell. That was my commission list. And Eric, you bass over there. Yeah. And now you're definitely on that list with them, which is hopefully distinguished company. But how would you say your art style has evolved since you started?
Faster. I pay a little bit more attention to anatomy now than I used to. Sometimes you get bloggers that want to cut up your anatomy, so I listen to the critics and I try to do the best I can.
Yeah. Well, being that, of course, you're very recent, and you mentioned of Jason Scott Campbell on all those, why do you feel your artwork has become so popular among fans?
A lot of it has to do with, the style. People like the style of artwork, but also getting published, like with Zenscope covers get a lot of eyeballs, so I find that people gravitate towards the Zenscope stuff and then find me through that, and also through Deviant and social media too. I do a lot of advertising on Facebook and DeviantArt.
Well, again, you do fan service very well, and of course you made mention of being Zenscope. Though, just to get a little serious for a moment, of course, one of the big controversies that has come up in the years is how women are drawn and that stuff. How do you feel about that current controversy about how artists draw women, and do you feel it's fair sometimes to the artists?
Well, I'm of the opinion that anyone can have their opinion of any kind of artwork that they like, and as far as the artists are concerned, the artists have the right too to have their opinion on how they draw and what their style is. So if I've had a couple people complain about my style or my anatomy, and that's great. They can complain, or they can, you know, they can post it on blogs or whatever, but I also have my own style, and that's the way I do it, and that's what my fans gravitate towards, so I'm not going to change it. I try to draw my women, the women that I try to draw them in strong, sexy poses, not pornography or anything like that, but something that's strong and sexy. And it's funny when I have critics that say about the women, or, you know, being drawing them improportionately or whatever, half of my fans are women. You know, when I go to a Comic-Con, half of the people that buy my art prints are women.
It's one of those things where it's Jim Valent, whether it's Jason Scott. I haven't talked with Jason Scott Campbell, but when I read his interviews, but I recently talked with Jim Valent, I interviewed him. You know, and all these artists that do fan service, I feel that like 75% to 80% of their fans, women.
Yeah, they're women. Honestly speaking, like, most of my fans, the fans that like my Wonder Woman, Mary Jane, all the Red Riding Hood, all the Harley Quinns, all the people that buy those are women.
Well, I'll be buying a Mary Jane in a minute, so I guess I turned it to them.
Yeah, and the women that do comment on my work say the same thing. I like the way you draw her. She's sexy, yet she's strong. And that's the number one comment I get on my work.
Yeah.
She's sexy but strong.
Absolutely. Well, final question is, even though you've only been around very recently, what do you think, or what do you wish?
Right with it. Sorry.
We're here at a live convention, folks, because live podcasting is awesome.
Yeah.
But what would you like for your other people out there to maybe pay more attention to when it comes to your work?
In the future, going forward, the way I can answer that question is just to say, like, what I would like to do in the future. I've had a couple publishers already approached me to do future cover work. So for me, I like doing the cover work. I like meeting the fans at conventions. And as long as I can keep doing that, then I'm happy. I have the best job in the world right now, and I couldn't ask for anything more.
Absolutely. But do you want to pimp where people can find your artwork on the web?
Sure. You can go to jamietindall.com, or you can also find me on DeviantArt at jamietindall.deviantart.com.
Absolutely. And thank you, Vince. And we will be back with another interview in just a second. Hey there, fans. We're back with another interview. We're here with Bob McLeod. Am I saying it right? Bob has worked on Spider-Man, he's worked on Superman, he helped create the New Mutants, and we're here with him for a couple of questions. So, first question, how did you get started in the industry?
I moved up to New York, tried to get started in Marvel and DC, and got rejected over and over. I was up 3 months knocking on doors trying to get started, and wasn't getting anywhere, and I finally met Neil Adams. And Neil Adams looked at my samples and picked up the phone and called Marvel and got me a job in the production department at Marvel, just on his recommendation. And then being in the office, you know, I met the editors and showed them my work and went freelance about 6 months later.
Now, of course, so you've been in the business for such a long time. How did you come around to your art style, and how would you describe it, and how do you feel it's evolved over the years?
Well, when I was starting out, I wanted to be a humor artist, doing satires like Mort Drucker and Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
So my style was very much like Mort Drucker's, and I was thinking I would be a cartoonist rather than a comic book artist. So once I got into comic book business, I had to change my whole style to fit comic books. And I studied Neil Adams and John Buscema, who in my opinion, were the best two artists in the business. And so I set them as my role models and geared my style in that direction. And because I'm not John Buscema and Neil Adams, you know, my own style evolved regardless, whether without even trying. My own personality comes through, and I had a lot of other influence as well, so they just kind of combine and gel and take your style in a certain direction.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a perfectionist, so my style tends to be really detailed and exact and clean rather than sketchy. So sometimes I would work against that and try to loosen up and get rougher. Other times I like going really clean and neat. So it depends on the project.
Yeah. Now, a lot of the work you've done over the industry has as an inker, and you've inked so much stuff. I tend to find out, like, inkers and colors sometimes don't get the notice like the rock star artists do. Do you feel that inkers and colors don't get the type of respect maybe they should? When I see, like, people like you, like John, I believe it's Jean Poncier, who works on Ultimate Spider-Man, who's made the inks on that beautiful.
Yeah, it's a shame because I think it's mostly people don't understand inking. They don't understand what the inker contributes. And it can be a lot. It can be just a little bit, but the inker does make a difference, which to me is pretty obvious if you see a comic printed from pencils or just compare the same penciler inked by two different inkers. Same with colorists. The colorist really can make or break a comic. And people just tend to focus on the penciler because I guess it's just easier. It takes less thought and knowledge to appreciate what the penciler's doing. But, you know that going in as an inker or a colorist, that you're not the primary focus, and it's just part of the job, so you get used to it.
Yeah, you know, I definitely, like I said, I pay attention because, like, right now in the industry, Poncier is, like, one of the best, I think, inkers in the business right now working on Ultimate Spider-Man. Next question is, you've been a part of so much stuff. You helped create the New Mutants. You inked most of Kraven's Last Hunt with Mike Zack and J.M. DeMatteis, who I got to the Pleasance to talk with about 2 months ago. And, of course, you worked on the early 90s Superman, which really helped set up into the whole death and then return of Superman. So for all three of those parts, what do you feel was your favorite part about working on all three of those achievements of your career?
Well, they're all different. With the New Mutants, I was able to get in kind of on the ground floor and help do a lot of the creating of the series. And it was a very much of a rush job, though. So it was very frustrating because I couldn't do my best work. I was just constantly too rushed to do my best work. So as good as it was to get on the ground floor, that was one of the most frustrating jobs of my career, really. And then with Superman, I had not done penciling for a while. I'd been focusing mainly on inking before I did Superman. So when I switched over to penciling Superman, it was a pleasant, nice change from doing so much inking to think about storytelling and figure drawing. So I had a great time on Superman, but I really want to pencil and ink my own work as much as possible. So after a couple of years, I got tired of just doing the penciling and having other people do the inking. And I wanted to do it all myself, so that's why I left Superman. Kraven's Last Hunt came about because Mike Zeck and I are friends, and he asked me to ink it for him. And I enjoy inking Mike, and had a great time on that. Had no idea it would be the landmark series that it's become while I was working on it. But it was great fun.
Yeah. Final question is, of the work you've done over the years and years, is there any particular pieces you wish maybe people would pay more attention to that you've done?
Well, of course, like I say, I wanted to be a cartoonist when I started out, and I did a lot of work for Marvel's Crazy Magazine, which was their version of Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
All my work in there, I'm really proud of, and most people don't even know about it, so it'd be nice if they could check that out. People think of me mainly as an inker, and I've done a ton of inking, and I enjoy inking, I love inking, but I've also done a lot of penciling. I did a lot of fill-ins on Spider-Man. I penciled Star Wars for a few issues, like you said, Superman. I've done some miniseries, Spider-Man and Punisher miniseries, a Venom miniseries. I've done my Superhero ABC book that I penciled and inked and wrote myself. So there's a lot of things I've done that maybe went under the radar of most people.
Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much for giving us just a little bit of your time. You're working on a Phoenix cover, which it's looking very good. And I thank you for your time. Is there a place on the web people can find you?
Sure, I have a website, BobMcLeod.com. And I also am on Facebook quite a bit. I've posted a lot of my art on Facebook, and that's a good place to interact with me if you want to. I'm also on Twitter, but I very rarely use it. So my website or Facebook are the ways to find me.
Well, and thank you, fans, for listening. And we will be back in a second with another interview. And comic book fans, we are back with another interview. We are here with Bill McKay, and I hope I'm saying that name right.
Yeah.
Being from camp, I had a lot of work practicing with Rich McKay, who was the general manager for the Buccaneers for a long time. No connection whatsoever. Actually, funny enough, when I pulled your name up on Wikipedia, it gave me a dead Scottish football player.
There are a lot of Canadians named Bill McKay also,
I found. I just find it funny. It's like everybody else I could pull up on Wikipedia, but when I tried to pull you up, it gave me a Scottish soccer player from like 1906.
Nice.
But we're here with Bill McKay, who does zombies and cheerleaders. So he also does lots of cards and tons of other stuff. So first, how did you get into the industry?
I was working on a creator-owned comic about 2 years ago, and I heard through a friend that Zombies vs. Cheerleaders was a card set, and they were making a comic book out of it, and they were looking for somebody to submit a pinup. I submitted a pinup, and it ended up being a cover, and I've been working with them ever since and haven't gone back to my creator-owned book since. I haven't had the time.
So how many years would you say you've been in the industry?
I would say just exactly a month, just over 2 years.
Just over 2 years? Yeah. So overall, how did you come around to your art style, and how would you describe it to people, and how do you feel it's evolved over the years?
I always liked cartoonish, but I've always liked it, gore and sex. And I just always thought when I was younger that, like, brutal, Disney style, but if it was a brutally, like, kind of Disney with a shotgun was kind of the...
Disney done by George Romero.
Yeah. Just fun. I wanted to have fun with it, but I also wanted to be over the top. And a lot of the stuff I do, it comes off really gory, but when I look at it, I don't think of it like that. I think of it as more cartoonish than that.
That's, by the way, how you should start promoting your artwork. Disney, if it done by George Romero.
It's good. I like that.
So, besides the obvious, because you both do sketch cards and you do comic books, what do you feel is the biggest difference between drawing sketch cards and comic books?
They're working with markers. I've been drawing. I was a pen and ink artist for most of my life, and when I worked on Zombies vs. Cheerleaders, I got the opportunity to work on cards, and that was 2 years ago, and I'd never worked with markers, and I don't even like to see the stuff I was doing 2 years ago. And the stuff I can do with comics, I can manipulate in Photoshop, were cards, working with markers. It took me, I'm getting better at it, and it took a while, but it's very different.
Yeah. Well, on to the question that a little peel back the curtain for you folks. You know, I give the guests the question so they can see what's coming, and this is one of those that Bill was eyeing. What do you think of the current controversy about how artists draw women? And do you feel it's fair?
You know, I don't know how to answer that particularly, as far as I do a lot of stuff that's female-based. I think it's somewhat fun. It's a lot of big boobs and kind of ridiculousness, but the stuff, the really, because it's cartoonish, but as far as the violence, female violence and a lot of stuff I see online, and I don't like to go over the line, and it's just because it's not my taste. I just really, it turns me off, the reality of hard bondage and violence against women and rape and stuff like that is really not what I'm all about.
Well, do you find that a lot of your fans that come and buy your work are women?
No.
No, it's mostly men?
Yes.
Well, you know, it is a trend that sometimes I see, especially with a lot of fan service artists, is a lot of their fans are women. So, you know.
Oh, I've sold plenty of things to women, but yeah. The majority is now are definitely
women. Yeah. So, final question. Of the work you've done, what would you like people to maybe pay more attention to?
All of it. I got into cards. I didn't even know what cards were about, but I'm really enjoying working on cards, and I'm really enjoying working on comics. So I'm doing the Pop Art Con next week, which is a strictly card convention. I need to reach a card audience. My work is getting better in that, but I don't want to give up the comics either. I want to pursue both.
Yeah.
And I hope I can reach fans of each medium.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. Do you want to tell people where they can find you on the web? Because obviously you can't find you on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I guess the best place is BillMcKay.deviantart.com or at BillMcKayArt on Twitter.
Okay. And thank you, fans. And we will be back with another interview in just a second. Hey there, comic book fans. We are back with another interview with Jamal Engel. Got right on take two. You don't want to know what I said on take one. And he is another illustrator here at Wizard World Philly, or Philadelphia, whichever you might like. And he's going to answer a couple questions for us. So first, how did you get started in the industry?
The long story short is I actually got my start as an intern at DC Comics back in 1989. I did a six-month internship there. And then from there, went to School of Visual Arts, dropped out, moved to Canada.
Canada.
Yes, Canada. I love Canada. It's an entire country of guys named Doug.
And Scott.
How's it going, eh? So I kid my Canadian brothers. So I came back. I was working at a couple of different comic book shops while I was pitching my wares at various comic book companies. I ended up doing some work for a company that immediately folded business 6 months after I got started. But I took those pages, I sent them to DC Comics, and I got my first published work, which was Green Lantern 52. So that's the long story.
So how do you feel you came around to your art style, and how would you describe it to people, and how do you feel it's evolved over the years?
How do I describe my art style?
Yeah.
Naturalism. I think that's basically where that's how I feel that my art style is basically is. I'm not, I do sort of a... I do sort of a, what's the best way to describe it? An altered kind of realism.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to go for a specifically photoreal look for my work, but I'm not going for completely cartoony look for my work. So I try to balance the two so there's enough of a animation style squash and stretch where needed, but you know, more of a realistic approach.
Absolutely.
You know, at the same time. So that's how I tend to try to describe my work. As far as how it's evolved over the years, I don't know if it's so much of an evolution as improvement. I think, you know, if you look back at my work over the years, my basic style has always been there, you know, but after, you know, 20 plus years, you just sort of get better at it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you brought up animation, because the next question is, you've also worked on storyboards and stuff, which
right.
include things like Max Steel.
Yeah.
And I actually remember what Max Steel was about, which makes me feel old.
Hey, I drew the damn thing. How do you think I feel?
Way back in 1998.
Oh, man.
And it wasn't even that I was a teenager then. I was still a kid. And
oh,
I still feel...
Don't tell me that.
But what do you feel, besides probably the obvious, is the biggest difference between drawing storyboards for comics and storyboards for animation?
Well, the mechanics are different. I think that with comics... Specifically with comics, especially like American and Japanese comics, there are things that you can do visually. It's more about not just the actual storytelling itself, but it's about the overall composition and design of each page, how each page flows into the page that follows it, and so on and so forth. In animation, you're only concerned about what you can fit into that TV frame. So you're trying, even more so than in comics, you're trying to mimic the movements of a camera, as opposed to in comic books, where you're a good comic book artist is able to incorporate the storytelling into an overall sense of design.
Yeah.
So, and there's a different cadence to it. There's a certain type of timing in animation that doesn't apply to comics, and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you also teach now as
right.
well, what do you feel is the most important intangible for an aspiring artist to have to make it in this business?
Patience. I always say the same thing. When you're a young artist, you want to burst forth onto the world.
Yeah.
You know, you want to be fully formed and have all your powers about you. But art is an evolution. It's a constant state of change. You're constantly learning things and improving and growing. If you're doing it the right way, you know, your work is constantly, from panel to panel, improving, from page to page improving, from book to book improving. So you're in this constant state of evolution. So the thing is you have to be patient, because it's not all going to come all at once. It may never come, all, you know, and it may never end up the way, you know, you envision something in your mind. You know?
Yeah.
But if you're lucky, you eventually move closer to that reality. You move closer to being able to take what the image that you have in your head and applying it into a two-dimensional space.
Absolutely. So with that being said, final question is, of the work you've done over the years, what do you wish people maybe would pay more attention to?
Pay more attention to?
Yeah. Like maybe you had you did a run on a comic, maybe when you were just beginning, that you thought was really good, and you would like pay people to see it. Well, just to kind of see the evolution of your art, or something like
well,
that.
Well, no, I don't know. That's such a hard question.
It's also a different question when somebody asks you,
yeah,
"What's your favorite thing?"
Yeah. No. I think probably I did this mini-series, or what ended up being a mini-series, called Venture for Image Comics back in 2003. And it really is sort of the sort of like the break in, you know, in terms of artistic evolution, for lack of a better word. That was sort of the point where I found my voice finally, and I, you know, started kind of, you know, honing in on that style. You know,
yeah.
Which is, you know, evident in my current work, but a lot of the techniques that I use now, I developed while working on those four issues.
Well, thank you for giving us a bit of your time. Do you want to let people know where they can find you on the web?
Yes, you can find me on on the web at JamalEigel.com. On Facebook, same thing, Jamal Igel. Twitter, Jamal Igel. Everywhere, Jamal Igel. Or you can look up one of my creator-owned projects that's coming out next year called Molly Danger, and you can find that on Facebook at Facebook.com/GoMollyDanger or GoMollyDanger.blogspot.com.
Thank you very much. And comic book fans, we will be back with another interview in just a second. Hey there, comic book fans. We are here with another interview here at Wizard World Philadelphia, and I am here with Mike Diodato Jr., who's penciled many great comics, including one of my favorite story arcs of all time, Sin's Pass, from Amazing Spider-Man. If I believe right, as I cheat, 509 to 513. So we're here with him, and he's going to answer a few of our questions. So first, how did you get started in the industry?
In American industry, I came via a studio in Brazil that was representing Brazilian artists in American comics. And the first book they offered me was Santa Claus by Malibu. And after that, I never stopped doing work for American market. So, but my first hit was Wonder Woman to DC Comics.
Absolutely. So how would you describe your art style, and how do you feel your art style has evolved over the years?
Well, it's hard for me to realize that I do have a style of my own, because I'm always trying to find out something new or improve my craft. And I have so many influences, so it's hard for me to say. But basically what I evolved from the point of view of the narrative, the storytelling. It grew a lot. I had problems with in the 90s doing, paying more attention to big scenes, and I used to forget about the story, and now I know the story is the most important thing in the comic.
So as I mentioned before, one of my favorite story arcs is Sin's Pass. I just, but from art and writing, the emotion that comes from that story, from the reveal about Gwen Stacy, which in my mind did so much for Gwen Stacy's character, more than the past 50 years of history have done for Gwen Stacy's character. So I was wondering, in working with J. Michael Straczynski, or JMS, what was the sort of communication and dialogue between you as you tried to translate the emotion of the story?
None. No, the only communication I had with Straczynski was one where he reminded me that I should not put any poster of the witches in Peter Parker's room. Okay. Because the witch was being released at the same time. Then I took the chance to put a lot of posters and please don't do that. That's the only communication we had. But I have almost no communication with the writers about story, because they trust what I do, and then I'm lucky, I guess, because usually they say that I draw exactly what they were thinking. So I think it's come with experience, I guess.
In drawing the scenes, I mean, did you feel it was important to try to portray the type of emotions that Peter Parker was going through, Mary Jane was going through, with this huge reveal of this sort of dark secret of Gwen Stacy?
Yeah, it was an opportunity for me to play with my strengths in this area of emotions. And I grew up in Brazil, and they have a strong side on soap operas there, and they use a lot of close-ups, and then I use what I learned from watching soap opera, and It was a great exercise. I love to do that.
Absolutely. So, final question is, of the all the work you've done so many years, like you said, Wonder Woman, you know, Spider-Man, all the stuff that you've done, New Avengers that you've gone to, and Secret Avengers recently, is there any work that you wish people would maybe pay more attention to because you thought, like, I did such a good job with this and, you know, I would like people to see this work more, like, independent or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I did JD Warriors in the 90s. And nobody saw that. I'd like some people had paid more attention to that. It was great to do it. Maybe I bring it back.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mike. Is there a place on the web where people can find you?
Oh, the Glass House Graphics website. I have a page there.
Okay. Absolutely.
And I'm on Twitter, too.
It's Twitter.
Yeah,
Twitter. Everybody's getting on that Twitter.
Yeah.
So thank you, and thank you, fans, and we will be back in a second with another interview. Hey there, comic book fans. We are back with another interview here at Wizard World Philadelphia, and I am here with Sonny Lee, who is an artist who's worked on Gen 13, Batman. I believe you've done a little Marvel as well?
I've done Marvel.
He's going to join us for a couple questions here. So first, how did you get started in the industry?
I went to the Cooper School for about 2 years, and then basically it was just legwork. Hitting conventions, talking to editors, building relationships, and then going to New York and talking and actually working with editors as far as what they wanted to see, and then literally going back and producing it and going back like as quickly as you can to show that not only can you produce the work and make the changes, but you can do it in a timely fashion, which is what's very important to an editor.
Absolutely, absolutely. So how did you come around to your art style, and how do you feel you would describe it to people?
Well, my art style is probably a mix of just about every artist that I've ever been a fan of. I mean, mostly the big ones like John Byrne, Jim Lee, probably Adam Hughes is there. Basically, though, when you mix it all together, it ends up absolutely looking nothing like any of them put together. So it's kind of like a conglomeration of aspects of different people's art that I find that I really like. You know, lately it's been kind of a Dave Finch. There's also a bit of a Ivan Rice in there as well. I'm a big fan of his too. So I kind of incorporate the elements of their art that I like and try to blend it together and make it work with whatever I do. Because I can't do a straight, you know, translation into my own because it doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you kind of have to adapt it and kind of fix it a little bit and try and blend it in with your own style.
Yeah. And by the way, that wasn't the voice of God you heard, folks. That's the loud PA system here at the convention center. a second part of that question, I think you were kind of answering it there a little bit, was how do you feel your art style has evolved over the years?
Well, in the beginning it was kind of a more loosey-goosey manga style, you know, but as I went along I realized that that's not really the stuff that I've been kind of attracted to artistically, so I kind of moved away from that and went more towards the, I don't want to say like the straight up Alex Ross realistic style. That's not me either, like Tommy Lee Edwards or John Paul Leon.
Yeah.
I like kind of a comic book style. It's still realistic, but not kind of like Neil Adams, Ivan Rice, and that kind of mold.
Yeah.
So I kind of follow that path.
So when you're drawing, what's the mindset that you usually put yourself into as far as thinking about how the character should look, you know, the emotion of the character that you're drawing?
Well, the emotions is told by the story, so you got to go through the entire script, make sure you get everything down, and then you kind of take notes as you go along and make sure that you got the right, you know, mood, the right scenery, the right background, so that when you put it all together, it showcases the elements, the emotion that you want it to convey. And as far as the look, you know, I don't want it to be like, you know, I don't want to be the artist that has, like, you know, the generic face, different mask, new superhero, you know what I mean? I want to give it the elements. So I think about, like, Captain America, for example. Traditional, heroic, you know, so he's got the square jaw, thicker neck, rounder, blue eyes,
things like that. And then you get into, like, you know, maybe, you know, Punisher. He's kind of dirty, grungy, really scarred, beat up, you know what I mean? That kind of vein. So he's kind of not as square-jawed, kind of more squinty-eyed, kind of, you know, kind of seething, angerish, kind of, you know? So you're trying to portray elements of the character's personality to their face. So you don't want to, you want to kind of blend it together in a certain way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So what do you feel is the funnest part of your creative process when you're drawing?
I like just working on the details outside of the, like, the pose and stuff. I like putting things in there that, I don't want to call them Easter eggs, but I like to put in things in there that a lot of people think about. So, you know, I want to make kind of a unique creation. So, put my kind of spin.
Absolutely. So the final question is, of the work you've done, what pieces would you wish people maybe would pay more attention to?
None of them. You know, in my case, I'm the kind of guy who is never happy with his art. You know, there's not enough time in the day to finish the page. There's not enough time for me to get everything that I want to put in there done. So, you know, I'm never happy, you know. And because comics is kind of a collaboration, not all the time will you get to pick the people you want to work with. And even if you do, it's not always a great mix, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm still trying to work through the pencils, the inks, because, you know, I, for my part as a penciler, a lot of my stuff is tonal. Like, I use a lot of, when I, even when I know it's going to be inked and it's going to be flattened out by the blacks of an ink, of an inker, I don't see it when I'm penciling because I have a tonal pencil and I have three tones and stuff, so it's difficult for me to make that transition. So, a lot of my stuff that I draw and I see it inked in colors, I'm like, yeah, what the heck happened there? Probably could have done a better job. So I'm actually kind of experimenting with inking myself so that I can get a better idea of what it's going to look like when it's finished. Kind of take away the tones and take away the elements that I'm putting in there. You know what I mean? So.
Well, thank you. Is there a place on the web where people can find your work?
Yes, I'm at sunny615 at DeviantArt.
And thank you, fans. And we will be back with another interview in just a second. Hey there, comic book fans. We're here with another interview. We are here with Christy Zullo. She is an artist. She's done stuff for Vertigo. More importantly, she did Fables, Cinderella from, I guess, Fable Towns with Love, which is a great book. I remember it was one of the books I first picked up when I started going to the library. I used to live in down in Florida, and we had a library that had a great graphic novel selection, and one of the first ones I picked up was Fables, you know, Cinderella from Love. Wonderful, wonderful story. If you love sort of classic spy stories with fables mixed in, it's a wonderful story, and she did the art, and it's gorgeous art, and so she's here to answer some questions with us. So first off, how did you get started in the industry?
I went to San Diego Comic-Con with a portfolio that I had put together of a lot of illustrative art. And what DC does is they do, like, talent searches at really big shows. So I submitted my portfolio, and every day they pick 10 people to meet with an editor. And one of my portfolio got picked, so I got to meet with an editor and just kind of, like, went from there. So.
So how did you come around to your art style? How good do you feel you would describe it, and how do you feel it's evolved over the time?
I think it's constantly evolving. Like, how did I come up with it? I guess I've just been so influenced by so many things. I mean, art history, a lot of Japanese art, comic book artists. I mean, every day, like, I find new artists to fall in love with, you know? So I just kind of take a little bit from everyone I like and just kind of keep growing, keep evolving, hopefully keep getting better, and keep changing, I guess. So growing as an artist. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely, absolutely. What do you feel is your mindset when you're drawing in the Fables universe?
My mindset, I guess I would describe it as, like, whimsical, but still in an adult tone. Fables is kind of cool because it's kind of this mix of fairy tale meets, you know, murder mystery meets, you know, war stories. So it's kind of a cool world to work in. So I guess I just, you know, take from the classic fairy tale, but like put it, you know, more of an adult twist on it, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, one of the current, you know, sort of controversy, there's always a controversy going on in comics, and one of the current ones is how women are treated, more specifically how they're drawn in the industry. You being a female artist, you do wonderful art, and you draw, I think, females just as sexy as some of the other cheesecake artists. It's just a different style. So how do you feel about this controversy of that, and do you think it's a fair controversy?
I think it's fair. I think, like, people have a valid argument over it. I personally, as a woman, like, I don't get offended, but, you know, I understand, like, the appeal, I guess. It's just every artist is different, so, you know, some guys draw females very sexy, and, you know, some females draw females very sexy, so, I don't know, it's just kind of like, you know, whatever your style is. As a female, I don't take really any offense to it. I think it's great to, you know, have strong female characters, so, you know, I'm happy with it.
Absolutely. So, final thing is, because you've done a very limited work, but, you know, maybe something maybe you did before your portfolio got seen or everything. Is there anything you'd wish maybe people would pay more attention to? Maybe something within the art you'd like them to see?
Like, what do you mean? Like, there's something that I would like to do, or...
Maybe something like a quality of your art you think people would find neat, that, oh, like, it's inspired by this, or something within your art that you think they may find interesting.
I guess, I don't know, my art, it's really inspired by so many, like, a lot, like, Adam Hughes or, you know, Travis Charest, but also, like, Japanese anime, you know, it's just, like, a weird thing of, like, everything that I like. So.
I definitely get the feeling that Yoshito Amano is...
Yeah, Yoshitaka Amano, yeah.
Actually, when I first saw it, I thought him, and I'm blanking on the artist's name, but the artist who would do the ending credits for Outlaw Star.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you... Did you...
No, I'm not familiar.
there were some similarities from that I saw in your art.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, I definitely have, like, a little bit of influence from everybody, so...
Yeah.
It kind of reflects, I guess, all the things I liked.
So, do you want to let people know where they can find you on the web?
Sure. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. My blog is chrissyz.blogspot.com, and on DeviantArt as well at chrissy-zulo.deviantart.com.
And thank you, comic book fans, and we will be back with another interview in just a second.
And welcome back, and thank you for listening to the special Absolution Network Comic Book Crazy 132 Productions Wizard World Philadelphia 2012 Con Report with interviews. Once again, thank you for going through probably a long episode. Again, sorry, by the way, about the background noise in the interviews. Again, conducted at the convention, there's a lot of noise. I'm actually very happy at how it turned out. Listening to the recordings, it was very clear to make out the artists as they talk. So that was something I was worried about. I'm glad that came out well. But, you know, our time has come to an end. So, alas, parting is such sweet sorrow. But it's time for us to go. So remember, for both Absolution Network and for Comic Book Crazy, there are multiple ways to get in contact with us. First, with the Absolution Network, you can email us at absolution132@yahoo.com. That's absolution132@yahoo.com. And of course, you can find us on Facebook by searching out Absolution Network. We are not yet on iTunes, thanks to iTunes being lazy. But, of course, you can always find us and leave comments on the site itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And for Comic Book Crazy, you can leave us email by emailing to comicbookcrazy1@yahoo.com. That's comicbookcrazy1@yahoo.com. yahoo.com. Of course, we do have an iTunes feed for that site, which you can find by searching out Comic Book Crazy on iTunes. And of course, there's always a site where you can leave comments at, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, you know, why don't you check out my other site that, you know, is not being sponsored for this Comic-Con, which is Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast reviewing every Godzilla movie ever made. You can find that site at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. Of course, while you're at any of the sites, there is a sidebar that has our many friends, many of which you heard promos for during the episode. This includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box and Crisis of Crisis, a Superman podcast that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Zeiger's Major Spoilers podcast, and Scott Gunner's Two Freaks, along with all our other friends who you can find again on the sidebar of the site, so check them out. So that is it, again, for the Wizard World Philadelphia 2012 Con Special. Until next time, my comic book fans, my Absolution Network fans, stay golden.
A curse to samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort, but I am not worried, for one day you will fail.
Listening to the Toonami Black Hole Megamix by DJ Clark Nova. Don't sleep on it.